The first item on our agenda this morning, we're going to be hearing from Dr. Leslie Halleck, who's provost of the Oregon Health Sciences University. Before we call our panel up, I'd just like to announce to the audience that we have scheduled today House Bill 2447, and there have been some problems that have arisen with that bill. It may need some additional amendments. So we will not be moving that bill out today. And if there's anyone that was here to testify, certainly we would make that available to you. But there will be further action on that bill. With that, I'd like to call Dr. Halleck forward, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at Oregon Health and Science University. I hope that you have in front of you a handout, which is a copy of the slides. And I guess when you can, if you could lower the screen again, that would be very helpful. I am here, as I understand it, to talk to you a little bit about the healthcare workforce crisis that we believe we're facing in some sectors immediately, and in others it's out a few years. But because the training period is so long for physicians and dentists in particular, we feel the urgency today. And so I want to tell you a little bit about the shortages as we see them, particularly for physicians, dentists, and nurses, and what we're doing about that and what we propose to do about it. I know you are focused on workforce, so I assume you've seen data like this, so I'll go through it very quickly. But as I'm sure you're aware, we're facing a very dramatic change in the age distribution of the population. If you look at the blue on this graph, the inflection point represents a steep increase in people over 65. The blue are people that are over 65 or 65 or over, and if you see, that's about where we are today. We're right at the bottom of that steep rise in terms of the U.S. population that will be over 65. Why is this relevant to healthcare? I think you probably are well aware of the reason. As we age, we use more of it. And so this data that is in front of you is actually inpatient days that are utilized per 1,000 people as a function of age. And so if you look across the bottom, you see that the age cohort 65 to 69 is about where that curve starts to dramatically go up. And the reason there are different lines on there and different colors is to show you that this is a pretty intransigent problem no matter what you do to healthcare. We made some gains. The red line is 1988, and that shows inpatient utilization. The rest of the lines you can see are on top of one another from 97 to 2004. And what that means is we reduced the length of stay as managed care rolled in, and as the cost pressures mounted and the reimbursement structure shifted, that people stayed in the hospital for shorter periods of time and were sent home sooner, often with still additional care needed, but the length of stays were reduced. But you can also see that once that initial reduction occurred, not much more can be basically squeezed out of the system. These folks are really sick, and you just can't send them home any sooner. So you can see that we're facing this very steep uprise of the use of inpatient beds as a function of age. And if you combine that with the previous graph, it's a perfect storm. Now, another contributor to, and this is just outpatient data, and I won't belabor it, it's the same point. Basically, as you get older, you go to the doctor's office more often as well. This is compounded by the fact that you can say all those demographic things about the workforce. The workforce itself is aging. They're baby boomers, too. And so we're facing, at the same time we're facing this huge inflection in need, we're also facing a departure from the workforce of retiring care providers. Now, there are a lot of reasons for departure. One is just age. Some aspects of it involve stresses in the workplace that can be improved. Some of it is inflexibility in the workplace. That can also be improved. You can make the environment friendlier for older workers. You can bring them back. And a lot of those initiatives are being explored. But that's kind of a drop in the bucket. It might have a 5% effect, maybe even 10. It will help, but it's not enough. There's a much more dramatic intervention that's needed. Most people are familiar with this in nursing because we've been talking about it for quite a few years. But fewer people are aware of the looming crisis for physicians and doctors. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is that it's a long training period. So you tend to think of today's shortages. Hospitals can't fill their nursing slots, and you hear about that from your constituents. Physicians, the real crunch is going to hit in about 8 years. Well, it takes 8 years to train a doctor. In medical school, there's 4 years and then 4 years of residency before they can really practice independently. So to us, it's here now, and we have to tell you about it and tell you at least some things we think could be done about that. The other thing that's true across the country is that states haven't been very involved in planning for physician workforce or dental workforce issues. Generally, that's been a federal issue, and increasingly states are starting to see that they aren't going to be able to get doctor and dentist appointments, and so they're paying a lot more attention, just as you are. The other thing that challenges us has been that the production of doctors has been flat for 30 years. And dentists virtually flat. In fact, it dipped for a while. It's come back up a little bit. But so in contrast to nursing, which has done some changing in capacity, medical and dental schools really haven't ramped up capacity in anticipation of this and really haven't even talked about it all that much until the last 18 months or so. The population is also growing in this country, and that's not factored into any of the data I just showed you. This, the frank population is larger. And then finally, the last point under that first bullet is one I sort of hate to admit, but it's absolutely true. The educational model is not efficient. It's an apprenticeship model. It takes a lot of faculty relative to the number of students. It hasn't basically changed very much in 100 years, and you can't change it very rapidly. We've tackled that head on, and I want to tell you at least the little bit of progress we've made and a lot more we think we're going to make. The last two points I'm not going to talk about because they're also relevant, but not to the workforce topic at hand. Oregon faces another problem that several states face, and that is that there's also a distribution challenge. Some areas of the state are easier to populate with providers than others, mostly due to economic issues. Some of it is sort of preference of the provider and the need to be connected to a tertiary health system, and some of it, though, is just the economic base in rural communities is not always sufficient to sustain a provider population, and that's another challenge. But what we can do about this as educators is really encourage students and trainees to settle in areas that are underserved, and the best way to do that is to put them there during their training. A lot of them decide it isn't their cup of tea, but some of them just become passionate about it, and both of those are useful outcomes, actually. So putting people in the environment, and an anecdote, when we started our medical student rural rotations, we converted in the mid-90s to a mandatory rural rotation for all medical students. The first time we sent them out there, there were more excuses for not going than you can imagine. There were lots and lots of resistors who said, well, for this reason or that reason, I can't go yet, maybe next year. We didn't budge. We just rolled it on through. By the end of the first rotation, the very first rotation, it was the most popular rotation. The students loved it. They came back saying, now, this is a real doctor. This is what I came to medical school for. And they came back so enthusiastic that it has been our most popular rotation ever since. So it takes a little, you have to sort of grit your teeth when you start, but it works. The other impediment in this state and many others is that we have a very high tuition model. During the reductions in state support over the last 15 years to OHSU, we have countered some of that, not all of it, but some of that with increases in tuition. We've done it very carefully. We certainly don't like doing it, but the net result is that students graduate with a big debt load, and it's well over $100,000 per student average. I always say it's like having a mortgage without a house. These students have big payments. It inhibits them a little in terms of where they can settle and what kind of job they can consider. And that's very relevant when they're making those discipline choices, and you just have to factor that in. Now, this is not a forum where I'm going to talk a lot about OHSU in general. We have four distinct missions. Education is our first and foremost reason for existing as a university. But I would just comment that both research and delivery of healthcare, and frankly our outreach programs, also have an impact on workforce and economic development that's very significant, and in another forum, and when we talked in Ways and Means, we'll of course be talking about those things. I'm going to focus on education today, but I'll just remind you, and the data's in there, that we just passed 12,000 employees, so we're proud of this number. This just happened a couple of days ago. We have a lot of jobs, and they're family wage jobs, and so it has a very large impact on the state, both directly and indirectly. And I've just put that data and the growth of our kind of institution in there for your reference. But today I want to focus on workforce, and in particular not all the workforce folks that we train. We are not going to talk about, although they're important, engineers that are interested in biomedical engineering, or basic scientists who are interested in biotechnology and companies. We do that too, and that's a forum for another day, but because you can only take so much into a session, we focused on doctors, nurses, and dentists in all of our asks going into the governor's budget. And we've changed the way we deliver education in a very substantial way. It takes a while, and we're beginning that process. But the fundamental change is we're putting a lot more learners out into the community, into private practice, into community-based and learning environments, forming partnerships with other health systems, but also with other educational institutions. And that's what we want to tell you about here. We've also changed, and this sounds like a lot of words, and it is, we're academics, but we are really fundamentally changing the way we educate providers. They're very siloized historically. You have doctors learning over here and nurses over here and dentists over here, and they might run into each other in the gym, but there isn't a lot of didactic opportunity for them to work together. And when it does happen, the students love it. We've been engaged in a very deep strategic planning with a new president this year, and so every aspect of the institution is planning. The students, the student governance went off on a retreat, and they came back with their input to the planning being first and foremost, we want interdisciplinary education. We want to learn how to work as teams. It was music to my ears because that's an emerging priority of the strategic planning as well. Why is that relevant to capacity? It's actually more relevant to how they function when they get out. We don't train them to work as teams. That has to happen when they're thrown into the mix, when they start working. If they can go to work the minute they get out and know how to function with their counterparts and colleagues, it skips a whole learning process that makes them be able to hit the ground running. So it's a much more efficient process, and there's less on-the-job training. I mean, they still have to learn the system they're in, but they don't have to learn the skills of working together effectively. We're also using a lot of technology, and I won't belabor that, but happy to answer questions about distance learning. But in particular, I want to tell you about simulation. For years and years, people have tried to automate some of medical teaching with all kinds of computer programs, and most of the faculty, most of the providers sort of rolled their eyes and said, yeah, well, it's not the same. But in the last 5 years, there's really been a sea change. The ability of robotics to simulate a real patient and a real episode have become very much more sophisticated, and providers are much more interested in it. And it provides, you know, these kids are growing up on video games. They love this stuff. So they'll go in, and we construct simulation operatories or simulation med-surg beds environments with a one-way mirror and a little classroom on the other side, and the students watch whoever's in there experiencing the learning, and then they come back, and the trick as an aging chalkboard teacher is to keep your mouth shut, because what happens is the students debrief the learner, and they learn from each other, and occasionally you poke in some guidance, but generally they learn an awful lot, and then you know what happens? Think of the video games. They want to go back in and get a better score, and so they want to do it again, and their skills really develop before they ever get in a patient environment, which means when they get to the patient environment, we now increasingly call them immersion experiences because they're ready to go. They have this, a lot more skills than they used to have. They're much more useful, frankly, and a little less burden. I mean, still have to be shown, but they're less of a burden. And in fact, what our providers for clinical sites tell us is they can now be taught their system. And what we find with these students is that they're often, nursing in particular, hired by that system in the minute they graduate because of this. And the simulation is a big part of that. It is now part and parcel of the entire nursing curriculum. It's not as penetrated in medicine yet, but it's rolling in very quickly. In dentistry, we have a whole room. If you haven't ever seen this, you should come visit. The first 2 years in dental school, we used to call it Bob in a Box. I apologize if anybody's name is Robert, but we decided that wasn't terribly respectful in case people were named Robert, but it is a head that folds down in a box, comes up, has a whole mouth full of teeth, and the students do all their initial learning, how to coordinate a mirror and get everything right when you're in someone's mouth, and their initial skills on in drilling. They do that on these mannequins and in these stations with computerized screens, so it makes all the learning much more efficient, and when they do start working in their third and fourth year in the clinic, they have built up a set of skills. Same principle as the mannequin in the nursing environment that I just told you about. The last bullet here is another fundamental change. There's a lot more focus increasingly on prevention, on nutrition, on health, on exercise, on all the things that should also reduce the load on the health systems. The main change that OHSU is undergoing, besides all these sort of technical changes, is the settings are different. We are forming partnerships in the case of medicine with the University of Oregon and Oregon State. There's an announcement at 10 in this building today that will talk about a partnership in Corvallis. A couple of years ago, we announced a partnership in Eugene where we will put students on the ground, first-year students, because the basic science is very strong in those two communities, and increasingly around the state, third- and fourth-year students who are in their clinical training into networks of healthcare that are hubbed in Bend, in Medford, in LeGrand, and then, of course, Corvallis and Eugene. And there's no real limit to the clinical placements. And so that's a function of who has capacity to absorb these students. And the interesting thing that's happening in dentistry, for example, is that practitioners were never all that interested in having students in their offices. I mean, they're really kind of a nuisance when they're brand new. And now they want them. And we have a cadre of dentists who are having trouble getting junior partners. And they see what's coming. And they're willing to take some of these students. So the final point I'd make is that we have a ready infrastructure to support this model. The Area Health Education Centers have long been our educational outreach infrastructure that we started building when President Kohler came back in 1988. And it allows students to learn in situ, in the communities, in these mandatory rural rotations I told you about a minute ago. But it also, it finds housing, it helps support clinical mentors, it supports the technology of video conferencing or the distance learning. And the other thing that's incredibly important is it helps build pipelines. It helps recruit kids. We have summer camps. We have after-school programs. It builds interest in science and health careers from those communities. It makes them an option that they could really consider in terms of careers. So it pulls students in as well as delivering students out. I'm going to skip most of these in the interest of time, but I put them in for your reference. This shows the national data that says medical student graduations have not increased for a very long time. They've just been flat. And physicians are aging. The green is 20 years out after the blue, and you can see the age distribution of physicians has changed quite dramatically here. That's the baby boomer provider. Now, you've seen data like that in the past in nursing. It's not a different story here for dentists either. In Oregon, just to give you a feel for the number, one of the challenges is that we graduate half the national average of medical students per capita, and in fact, the many states around us don't have medical schools. So that compounds that. So we have a big problem here. We think, and we're just trying to validate this, it's hard to get exact data, but our projections show that about 1,200 physicians left the workforce in the past 2 years, during which we produced 200 more. So you can see the order of magnitude here of the challenge. Now, we don't have a problem with applicants. We have lots and lots of applicants to medical school. They've gone up over time very dramatically.
Excuse me.
Would you say that number one more time? The people who left and the number you graduated?
Yes, I certainly will. Let me see if I can get back to it. There it is. We think 1,255 physicians, now this is a projection, obviously, left the workforce in Oregon over the same period of time that we graduated, about 200. So it just gives you a sense of where we're headed. And we haven't hit the steep parts of those curves yet. So you can see where I'm going. I'm trying to build a sense of urgency, even though it may be a few years out, because it takes a long time to ramp up and change the capacity. We have...
excuse me. Sure. Representative Dolan.
I'm sorry.
Your sense of urgency, I represent House District 59, the Dalles. And... we have a call load that no other physician faces. If you work in the Dalles, you're on call every weekend.
Yeah.
And most evenings. If you look for support, we do not have a cardiologist right now. So that means that when you take a patient and you need a cardiologist, you're all alone.
Yeah.
You don't have any help. The salary that we offer is not commensurate with what's offered here in the Valley. Now, when you put those figures on the board, I think this panel is used to being shocked. It's a wonderful time to be entering the labor force if you're trained. It appears your sense of urgency struck home here. I feel like Alice in Wonderland. We have to run and run and run and run, and we won't stay in place.
Well, thank you. You know, there's a couple of good things. I don't want to take away your sense of urgency at all, but it is possible to recruit people to come to Oregon. And a tidbit that you may not be aware of, but we find very interesting, is that in our population, residents and non-resident students are just as likely to stay here. That's not true in most states. Most states keep their residents but don't keep their non-residents. In our case, they both like to stay, and that's true at the medical student and at the resident level. But another factor that is really in another forum that would help your situation is a locum tenens kind of arrangement where you could provide some relief. And we're looking at that through the AHEC infrastructure to put support so that they wouldn't have to take calls so often and they could go back for continuing ed. And so another piece of this is supporting people who are all alone in a community. And then it's easier to recruit into that community because it just isn't as scary, frankly. When you're all alone. But it is a huge challenge.
Dr. Halleck, before you continue, pardon the pun, but I think you've hit a nerve here, Vice Chair Riley.
That's great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Leslie, before I go on, I want to disclose that my wife is one of Leslie's professors and is the director of the Master Public Health Program at OHSU. And so I feel that her need maybe more than some of you, but and because my wife is always searching for recruits, but you mentioned, I want to go back to the number, the 1,255 versus the 200, and I think that even underemphasizes, because as you stated in your very next breath, there are states around us who don't even have a medical school. So regionally, we're looking at a much greater number.
That's right. Regionally, it's more of a challenge. Now, there are things being done to address that, but they're slow. They're very slow to ramp up. Washington has a five-state program where it's very similar to the way we're structuring our outreach within the state. But it's still, you know, it solves the problem by twos and threes, not by 20s and 30s. And so it's a very slow ramp up. So, yes, the data would be more dramatic if we looked regionally.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Holby also has a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking, I was trying to hold off my questions, and I think I'll wait till she finishes, but I do have some questions for her, so I'm going to wait and listen to her presentation. Thank you.
Vice Chair Lim.
I don't think I can wait.
Maybe you'll ask my question.
Okay. What I'm hearing from the retiring doctors, they told me they want to continue their practice because of the liability insurance so high.
Yes.
And they don't want to just bother and being sued. And is there any way we can resolve some of the problems? Maybe from our point of view, maybe we might be able to pass some kind of legislation limit the liabilities for the retirees.
It is a challenge, and it's especially a challenge if they work alone or in a small area where the practice might not sustain those insurance payments. We've worked especially through the rural coalitions to try and address that for OBGYN and family practice for deliveries, because that's an especially acute problem in the state. But I think there are venues where those discussions are helpful, at least where there's a subsidy or help in the insurance payments if people stay in the workforce. And there is legislation that needs a little fine-tuning. Now that it's been out a couple of years and people have practiced with it, there were some minor issues that would be pretty easy to fix and probably not that expensive, at least for areas where the need is most critical. To tackle it on a larger scale, of course, could be very expensive. So it's certainly part of the discussion, the liability environment, as we talk about the environment. I want to just to touch on a couple of specific things that are going on here, and I'm mindful of the time. We have been ramping up the class size as we can. In the last bullet, over the last really 6 years, when we faced a 20% reduction in the funding to the medical school, we've actually increased the class size by 20%. So we are squeezing everything we can, and we do have the applicants, in spite of the national trend, which is actually down a little bit. In Oregon, we faced a pretty sharp decline of Oregon residents applying to medical schools. And why did that occur? The tuition went up, and our national applicants went up, and so the perception was that it was so hard to get in, it wasn't worth trying. We've worked very hard to overcome that perception, and as you can see, we're making significant progress. It's 5 times more likely that you'll be admitted if you're an Oregon resident than if you're a non-resident. They're essentially, if they're qualified, guaranteed an interview. And so we and that's the key to admission, is a good interview, and really gives you your venue to sell yourself. And so it's a very important aspect. But the bottom line is capacity here. And so that's really what's holding us back. There's some brag points in here. We've been able to maintain our quality. We usually come in the top 2 or 3 in primary care and in match rates for our students going into residencies. So the quality isn't a problem. The applicant pool isn't the problem. It's all about capacity. So here are the initiatives in medicine that we've undertaken. We took a huge gulp, and we admitted 120 in September. That's more than we have the capacity to train. And now, can we sustain that? Is that foolish? Well, it may be. Some may judge us as foolish. We can handle this, but we could not sustain it if we don't have additional funding, and you see that's one of our requests. But we think we can sustain it once we get through this biennium, and that particular request has a 0 in the column for the subsequent biennium, because by then we'll have 120 times 4, and we'll have enough tuition revenue to sustain that ask. So that's an important aspect of that. The AAMC has called for, finally, a 15% increase, and 4 months later, they changed it to a 30% increase in the capacity nationally. It took a long time, but they have now called for that for the last about year and a half. But the regionalization, the third bullet, is really the important aspect of this. The programs that we're launching in Eugene and Corvallis will allow us to increase, and this is probably a very cautious prediction, 20 in each location. The model is you put first-year medical students there. You bring them back to Portland for the second year. That's a critical piece of this for a couple of reasons. That's when they have pathophysiology, a lot of the clinical sorts of things that would be extremely expensive to duplicate. You also need to demonstrate to accrediting agencies that their education is equivalent across the board, regardless of what site they attend in their first year, and that's one of the ways you integrate the program. But mostly, it's just all those teachings happen on the Hill, and it would be hard to duplicate. Third and fourth year, they can go back out, and it doesn't have to be the same day. Other students may wish to do rotations in other parts of the state, so we can place a substantial component of our class, maybe a fourth, maybe a third, maybe even half, ultimately, in other clinical settings, and don't need to build that capacity on the Hill just for that purpose. So it's a huge leveraging piece. I want to say a little bit about the other professions, but I'll be very quick, and just stop me if I need to stop. This is a funny-looking slide, but it's an attempt by the Dental Association, the American Dental Association, to essentially show you the same thing. And what they've chosen to do is to depict the net impact on the workforce of people leaving the workforce and students coming into the workforce. And if you can see where the 2013 is, if you go back up to the top of that sort of steep decline, that's about where we are now. We're kind of on the top of a cliff of a huge decline in the rate of people entering the workforce. When you cross over and you have all that blue on the left, that means you've got more people leaving than are entering by a lot. And that goes on for 30 years until the baby boomers really work their way through. And so if we don't do something to change what's... Yeah, that was poorly stated. Sorry about that. I'm one, too. But if we don't, at the end, increase the capacity, you just won't be able to get in to see your dentist. I mean, that's the bottom line. And here's some aging demographics you can look at, but it's pretty sobering if you start looking at them. And then factor in that people keep their teeth now. And they, at least if they're lucky and have had good dental care, and now there are things like implants that can substitute for extractions, there's a very different standard of care. That means you need more dental work. So there's that need is probably underestimated because it assumes the same picture. Applicants aren't a problem there, either nationally or here. We had over 1,000 applicants for 75 positions. We're absolutely constrained by chairs, by operatories. We just flat can't take another one until we have more capacity. So what are we doing about that? We have, this is another quality slide. One of the things we're doing is putting students out into practices. The ODA is extremely supportive of this approach, and we think that within 3 years, it'll take 3 years to ramp this up, a third of our class in their last 2 years. Now, this doesn't help the box with the head in it. We still need more capacity there. But at the end, they'd be out in the community, which means we don't have to operate such a big dental clinic. We see 80,000 patients a year in that clinic. But to ramp that up would be very costly. And so this is a way that we can enhance capacity again. The last thing about dentistry that I would say, and this is kind of a foretelling of what we think is coming, there is a special, students come out of dental school ready to practice. Very different than medical school. But there are residencies. And one of the things that's happening nationally is the residency called the general practice residency. Think family medicine equivalent in physicians. Have extra training. If they go into a rural area and they don't have an endodontist or an oral surgeon to refer you to, they can do those things. And so they're trained more in some of the specialty areas to do at least certain kinds of routine care. So they're especially important in underserved areas. But nationally what's happening is several states are looking at licensure, which is quite provincial, frankly, to be blunt. If you're licensed in one state, you can't practice in another. And they're looking at it as a cooperative where if you've had a general practice residency, your license would be accepted across the agreeing states. We aren't there yet, but that's but what's going to happen the minute states start signing up, and there's seven that are looking seriously at that, is that there's going to be a huge call for more GPRs to be produced because the capacity is so limited in the state. So we're looking at starting one of those. You tend to start them in hospital dentistry programs. This is probably 3 years out and something that I'll bring back to you next session, but it's a very important endeavor, and we're beginning to build the infrastructure to look at doing this. It will also help the distribution problem in rural areas. I know time is short. I think what I'm going to do is skip through the demographics in nursing. I want to point out one thing, though. The crisis in nursing is faculty. We don't have trouble recruiting faculty. We're very fortunate. Our programs are all in the top 10. People actually like to come to OHSU. We don't have too much trouble bringing in national, but the Oregon situation is in the community colleges. They have trouble recruiting faculty, and we need to produce more. We, OHSU, need to produce more. We have the graduate programs. One of the initiatives in the governor's budget is, in fact, to produce 20 more teachers a year, and we have a program coming forward that's really focused on educators, teaching educators, that'll be coming through the approval system. It's almost through our internal hoops, and it'll come out in a month. So those are very important aspects, and those are brag points. What I'm going to tell you now are the four things in nursing that we're doing. One is to expand the base. That's actually number two here. And that will allow us at the existing campuses, Portland, Klamath Falls, LeGrand, and Southern, to ramp up by 50 a year. The second is the first bullet, which is the Oregon Consortium. That's an arrangement across the state with several of the community colleges where we go onto that campus. And what happens is that it's the old-fashioned four-year degree. Remember those? They actually do still exist in some quarters. And what can happen to you if you're well-prepared coming out of high school is that you can do the prereqs in 1 year. You take 2 years of nursing from the community college faculty. You take that in the community college system. We come onto the campus, we OHSU, and provide the fourth year, and you end up with a baccalaureate in nursing. Now, if you exit with an associate from a community college, it can take you 2 to 4 years to obtain that baccalaureate. And increasingly, health systems, especially for advanced practice, for management, for specialty, want those baccalaureate or even master's prepared nurses. So the OCNE program puts us on the campuses, uses the capacity of the community colleges beautifully, and one of the wonderful things that's happened the last 2 years, it's really been incredibly fun for an aging academic officer, is that the educational sectors have been hand-in-hand developing these programs. So OUS has a healthcare package, the community colleges you'll hear about a healthcare package, and ours are all linked to allow those students to flow through, particularly in nursing, which is where the most coordination has been done. And they work very well together. So it's been, I mean, we've always gotten along, as it were, but this is particularly well coordinated to allow throughput of these students. I've already talked about teachers. The fourth bullet here is a proposal to establish, and some of you were talking about this before we started, a program equivalent to LeGrand, Ashland, and Klamath Falls on the Western campus in Monmouth. The Salem Hospital is extremely supportive of this and interested in it. It will allow us to draw some of the science students from Corvallis and also Monmouth and Western, and to produce students who can rotate in the Samaritan Health System and along the Mid-Coast as well as in the Mid-Valley. And so it'll provide a need that right now is a bit of a gap. So that's a program that there's a lot of excitement. It's a new one, and we can't start it unless it's funded, but we're all working very hard to put all the pieces together for that. I'm going to just go to the AHEC, because I want to mention that the infrastructure for all these is the AHEC, and it's the most cost-effective way we can support all these learners scattered hither and yon is with the existing infrastructure and technology and pipeline programs. So that's why that's in there. And I'm just going to go to the last slide. Our ultimate strategy here is to build our capacity. One of the vehicles we have in Portland is the Schnitzer campus, which is on the waterfront. That's a blank sheet of paper right now that we're very excited about because all the deans are working together. Remember the interdisciplinary concept that I was throwing out at the beginning? That's where it will be actualized. That's where we'll see really different learning laboratories with all the students together in the mix. But we're piloting all those things now so that we're ready when we're able to build that campus out. I've put at the back the requests we made to the governor's budget, what is in the governor's budget, that blue column, and just for your information so you can kind of see where we're headed, our current projection as to what each of those programs would cost in the 2010-11 biennium. Just this is kind of a full disclosure sort of confession here, because they are operating programs and they will continue, and I don't want to pretend pretend otherwise. But I would point out that the first one under medicine, where we've expanded our chassis, as it were, to 120, we're funded for 90, is a one-time ask. Because, we, as I say, by the time we have 4 years of students, the tuition will carry that. So we think we just have to get there, and we can ramp up to 120. But if we want to go to 200 and initially to 160, we need to put students elsewhere. And that's the concept of the regionalization. And I'll stop there. I apologize for running over. Take questions.
Oh, please. That was just excellent testimony. And I think, as Representative Dahlem has already said, you've gotten our attention, believe me. Questions or comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Holdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad I waited for my question, because you actually answered some of them in the rest of your testimony. But you know, I got to say that the state of Oregon is lucky to have you at the OHSU. And, you know, since you came down to Eugene and started in with, you know, creating that satellite and expanding our capacity, I'm so excited about that program, because I think it really helps address at least a piece of the problem. And I guess that's part of my question, because I'm looking at all the data that you've supplied us, and it's sort of alarming to see that the state appropriations, you know, since 1975 to OHSU has gone from 42% down to, what, 3%.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really alarming to me, and recognizing that this is, you know, one of the largest growing sectors of our economy and workforce, it seems it would really be a smart investment and pay us back to focus some economic and workforce development dollars in this arena. So in light of that, I'm, you know, because you've touched on a lot of different things, and I'm kind of curious where our economic development dollars would be best spent, and where state dollars would be best spent in your programs. And I'm guessing you're going to answer well all of those, but you know, because we're looking at your state appropriations through the Ways and Means process, perhaps. But we also have, this committee has a good look at economic development dollars, and I'm curious about, you know, you've taken a large step at increasing the capacity to teach, which we can see from your numbers is absolutely crucial. And I'm recognized, and I'm glad the governor is recognizing the need for the teachers, you know, to actually do that. But, you know, when we look at investing our economic and workforce development dollars, should we be focusing on helping you expand your capacity, or should we be advocating for increased operating budgets, or should we be looking at trying to help decrease the tuition costs? I mean, where do you see the most important focus there, or is,
yeah.
Should I not be trying to divide those up? Yes.
Well, Chairman Witt and Representative Holby, it's just an absolutely wonderful question, of course, and they're all important, is the answer. When we struggled with that same question, what's the strategy for the next session? How do we approach this? We know we can't solve all the problems at once. The base is incredibly important. We have not had inflationary increases, which is one of the reasons the percent state support has gone down. Now, to put that in perspective, almost all of that money from the state now goes into the educational programs, and it actually represents about a third of the support for education, tuition being a third, and anything else we can cobble together, primarily clinical revenue being the other third. We need this package first and foremost. And so when we sorted it all out, support for the base is incredibly important. There's a little of that built in here. You can see the second item in nursing, the second item in medicine are in fact core support to expand a little and stabilize that chassis, as we were calling it, and so is the first in medicine. Any additional support will help us both strengthen and will take pressure off tuition. So that's always welcome. It won't increase capacity. So we were very torn. You can see that there's some holes here. We had an initiative, if you look at the third initiative in medicine, It was to increase our resident student ratio from 50% to 75%. That does not increase capacity. But what it does do is graduate more students that are residents at a slightly lower tuition. They have $10,000 a year lower tuition. So that's $40,000 in debt by the time they graduate that they don't have. And so that helps distribution, and it helps their ability to choose primary care. So there are additional things, but I would be remiss, and I'm sure I'll have an arrow in my back, if I didn't say that these are our highest priority, and the AHEC infrastructure perhaps is the one closest to the economic impact because it allows us to support everything else. And that sounds odd. When I was asked that question by the governor's staff, what's your highest priority? I said, you know, this is going to sound strange, but it'd have to be the AHEC because that gives us the ability to do all these other things. And so there's technology in there. There are a lot of pieces. So there's lots of other things. You'll see things that will come through Oregon Inc. that have research development that we're involved in and we hope are funded. ETIC has engineering funding in it that we hope is funded because that's also part of the mix. Some of the insurance issues that you brought up are part of this, so all of those are important. But for us to ramp up the educational capacity, this we think is the highest priority. I don't know if I addressed your question.
No, I think you did perfectly. Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Lund.
Good. Thank you, Dr. Harlick. And my concern is that we need more doctors and physicians and nurses and whatever. But you mentioned in the area of prevention. And actually, I want to know, what are you actually doing for prevention?
Mm-hmm.
And this should be a big piece of the medical practice. And can you elaborate on those issues?
Certainly. Briefly now, and maybe in additional conversations later, one of the things that may sound odd, but nutrition was not necessarily a required element in many of the curricula. It was really historically focused on disease treatment, not disease prevention. That is now very much part of the process. Well-being. How do you take a patient history and determine whether they exercise, determine what their sort of state of mind is now built into the clinical practice teaching. So there's prevention from the point of view of patient behavior that's now being built into the curriculum from the point of view of things like nutrition. Another aspect that is increasingly covered is sort of drug interactions, which is another, that's prevention kind of late in the game, but it's still incredibly important to preventing crises. The other, which is going to, it may not sound germane at first, is really some of the end-of-life issues. Making sure you're doing what the patient and the patient family wants. And that's not so easy to determine. And trying to figure out, do they want to be cared for in their home? How do they want to approach their various aspects of health care so you prevent unwanted interference. And so it's kind of from start to finish looking at patient and family-centered care. We also collaborate, for example, the Naturopathic College and alternative medicine of various sorts, including acupuncture. Those are part now of our library consortium. There are collaborators and grants that are acquired together. So there's kind of an opening up of traditional medicine to looking at alternatives, to trying to develop better cultural competency, which is not something that's, I think, been as sterling as it could be, and so that you can see how you would approach things a little differently that might be more acceptable and perhaps better for the family. If you look at things like Native American recruitment, for example, there are three states that do it well: Washington, Oklahoma, and Minnesota. Increasingly, we're doing it better. We have a center there. But why those three? Because they have programs that are relevant for Native American students that they see as helpful to them and take into account and honor their cultures and history. So, you know, that's a form of prevention, really, is trying to tailor the curriculum. There's a lot of things. This will be a fun conversation.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Whitt. As you might know, I'm a proud alumni of OHSU. And
I'm part of the 2% that left my profession of being a dentist for the glory and the high pay of the legislature.
The proud and the wealthy.
Thank you.
That's right. One issue that kind of bothers me, and I talked to you previously about the nursing shortage, and is that we educate quite a few nurses, but we lose a lot of nurses in the first 5 years. Is there anything, why is that? Is there anything that we can do to help prevent that?
You know, there's two answers. They're sort of at cross purposes. One of the ways you lose nurses is that they go into other nursing things, like the insurance industry or community health. That's probably a good thing, because those are also needs. And so, but it's hard to track. And so some of the data is impacted. If you just look at kind of are they practicing in a hospital, you don't necessarily see the whole picture. But even so, it is an issue. And one of the things that we are engaged in and several health systems are is creating, they're called magnet programs, that make the environment more satisfying. And sometimes that means you have more control over your work environment. So having nurses involved in many of the patient care circumstances and advising on that are increasingly part of our bargaining. They're part of the environment. The other is the flexibility at the other end, and I mentioned that briefly, is trying to make it more easier for people to come back or stay longer in the workforce, maybe reduced hours, maybe more flexible. So we're trying to work both ends. But one of the things we're finding is this immersion at the end of their training. What happens is that they've had really a strong clinical preparation, partly through the simulation. They are immersed for their last year in a health system. By the time they graduate and are practicing, they just feel more confident. They feel more capable. And I think that first two or three years where it's overwhelming sometimes, isn't it quite as overwhelming, so they're in a better position to develop job satisfaction, feel good at what they're doing, and then progress. And so all those things help, but it isn't, there's not a single answer. You really have to get into the workplace and figure out what makes it uncomfortable and what makes people leave.
Let's see. We have Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank the programs that your university for the innovative approaches toward increasing the number of graduates that you're able to produce. When you came to Eugene and talked with a number of people, including Representative Holvey and myself, about the plans there, it became immediately apparent to me that you had figured out a way to increase the number of new physicians that you were training at lower cost per physician than you were able to do simply training people on the Hill. And right. And you've described already in great detail what some of the other advantages are. But I think it's important for us to know that, in fact, you're not only going to train more people, but you're going to do it at lower cost per. And I think that's really wonderful. This morning I learned something else which I did not know, and that is that as you increase the team teaching, as you increase the understanding of the various professions of the other professions, my belief is that you are going to end up with better treatment for people. I personally have been treated by an allopathic physician and also by a chiropractor.
Mm-hmm.
There have been times, I will admit, that I have been my own physician because I had to balance competing recommendations.
Yeah.
And I don't consider that good a long-term approach.
Okay.
I think I'm pretty bright. I'm a PhD psychologist. I can figure some of this stuff out for myself. But other patients may have more difficulty. And I am very pleased to hear that the medical school and the other programs recognize this as an issue and are starting to work on it in a positive way. The body, of course, is a great deal more than what the allopaths understand, and more than what the chiropractors understand, and more than what any of the other professions understand, and they all go together.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Witt and Representative Barnhart, I couldn't agree more. The team teaching has tremendous advantages for quality of care, both for students, but also actually these simulation laboratories are very important for in-service kind of continued training in terms of how to avoid those sorts of discordance that occur. I'd just add that while we've grown in things like research and clinical, the declining state support has really challenged that infrastructure, and one of the places you feel it first are in these interdisciplinary intersections. And so we will be talking to you further, especially in the next session as we build out the Schnitzer campus, about that interdisciplinary infrastructure piece, because we think we can raise money for some of those discipline-specific pieces more readily, but the interdisciplinary piece and the simulation is kind of one-time investment that's really sorely needed, and we're doing some of that, but I think as time goes on and we're trying to tackle these huge capacity issues, that will become key. And it kind of answers your question, too, because I think there's a lot of leverage in that. They tend to be one-time investments where you then have the capacity to train in a more effective way, both for numbers and for quality.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question. You know, I guess I've sort of followed some nurses that I've known.
do you want to rephrase?
I have a follow-up.
They didn't quite come out right.
That is quite what you meant.
But
follow-up,
but
Representative Holden.
Thank you. I'm blushing now. I'm kind of curious what kind of outreach is possible in trying to tap into the huge expertise that is acquired by nurses, for example, that have spent 30 years or 20 years or something of really high caliber nursing and have worked with an incredible array of doctors, charge nurses, and essentially have the experience and knowledge of many doctors, perhaps.
Right.
And so I'm kind of wondering, do we have an outreach program to try to tap into those folks to being teachers and educators? Because I see some of those folks get burnt out just physically and emotionally because of the intense pressures of their jobs as they rise up through the the ranks of nursing. And it seems like, to me, a huge resource that is not being tapped.
Well, we're just beginning to try and do that in a very organized way. There are two ways I would respond right away, but there's probably a lot we haven't thought of yet, so all suggestions are very welcome. One is that, as I described these clinical kind of webs and networks for the clinical training, that kind of person is the ideal clinical mentor. And so very often a hospital that has an experienced base of senior nurses, highly trained, is willing to take students in those immersion situations, and then they will provide or partner with us to provide the clinical teacher, so we don't have to send one down there, and in fact they're incredibly valuable. So hospitals sometimes will provide those clinical instructors. The other place where I see a potential is in this new the graduate initiative I mentioned that actually has a curriculum designed to create teachers. And taking someone, an experienced nurse, who might want to teach, say, in a community college or in a four-year program, and giving them that additional graduate training for the teaching is another way they could kind of change the way they work and pass on some of that knowledge base. So those are the two ways, kind of creating them into teachers in the actual classroom, but also in the clinical environment are sort of ways we could tap into that. So it's a great suggestion, and we're doing it, but probably not as fast as we should be. So, thank you.
Okay. Representative Gerard?
Thank you, Chair Witt. To follow up a little bit on what Representative Holby was stating about nurses and burnout, I was kind of wondering if you had anything to say about the explosion in healthcare as far as knowledge goes. I mean, it's just, you can't stay, I mean, it's really hard to stay current. And the specialties that now seem to be more required for nurses, that seems to be where the primary shortfall is right now. Right. Is the school trying to address the specialty issue within nursing and actually some of the other fields as far as that goes?
It's a great question, and I didn't emphasize it, but there's two things I would say to that. One is the OCNE program, although it's not the thing you usually hear about the OCNE program, you usually hear about the smooth articulation with community colleges, in fact, is an entirely new curriculum. And it was designed conjointly by all the nurse educators in the state and by the union and by the nurse execs, the senior management in hospitals, with just that in mind. Okay, we need them to be extremely competent. They have to have more advanced skills than ever before. We need that content to be in the curriculum, and it doesn't matter whether it's a community college or a baccalaureate institution, they still have to get that content. So that's one way at the front end we're trying to address it. The other end, we have graduate programs very often designed for specialists to become specialists that are increasingly more rigorous. Now, the average master's in the state is about a 45-credit run of a curriculum. Our master's in nursing are 75 to 80 credits. They're unbelievably intense, and they're all in the top 10 in the country. Recently what's happened is nursing nationally has said graduate practitioners need to be trained at the doctoral level. Well, you could argue with the credits I just gave you that they almost already are, but we have put forward, it was just finally approved through the last hoop, the state higher ed board, a nursing practice doctorate. That's not a PhD, which is a research-oriented degree. It is a practice degree, just like our nurse practitioners are now trained, which will give them additional experience, but also kind of prepare them to then impart that knowledge. It kind of comes back to yours to actually be training the future practitioners in specialty areas. They call it advanced practice, and that whole arena of advanced practice, once you've been a nurse for a while, very often you'll go into oncology or cardiology. Those are very intense. If any of you, I'm sure many of you have had those experiences if you've ever been with a family member after a bypass surgery, open heart surgery. It's the nurse in the intensive care unit that keeps that person alive. And they're managing 12 physiological variables simultaneously, and a good physician, a good surgeon will come in and look to the nurse to see how the patient's doing. And you just watch it and you know exactly what's happening. And that's because they have this specialized training in cardiology.
Additional questions or comments?
Thank you, Dr. Halleck, so very, very much. And our healthcare gap, where we're able to have adequate personnel, has been very well illustrated by your presentation here this morning. And as I say, in the words of Representative Dahlem, you've definitely caught our attention here.
Thank you for the opportunity to present. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so very, very much. With that, I'm going to close today's informational meeting, and I am going to move to what I suspect will be a very brief public hearing on House Joint Resolution 12. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify on House Joint Resolution number 12? Seeing no one in the audience, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 12 and open a work session on the same resolution.
Thank you.
Committee members, you'll see before you the dash 2 amendments to House Joint Resolution number 12. Just by way of information, we had dash 1 amendments that were submitted. And one thing that you'll find readily as you, if you look into battlefield statistics from the Korean War, a number of them are in doubt, and some of it is somewhat controversial. And to avoid the controversy, we went to the Veterans Affairs Department to get those figures, and therein is the basis for the Dash 2 amendments, which are responsive
to some of the concerns that were brought to us by the Korean War veterans in our previous hearing. And with that, Rick, would you briefly describe our Dash 2 amendments for the committee?
Thank you, Chair. And the Dash 2 amendments do a couple different things. Throughout on page 1, line 10, it does replace the word conflict with the word war, also this on line 14. And then it deletes the line 16 through 18, and it appears then, whereas casualties of the armed forces of the United States during the Korean War include 54,246 dead, of whom 33,741 were battle deaths, and 103,284 wounded. It leaves us details that actual number versus a kind of general number.
Sure. Thank you very much. Committee members, you've heard the description. Chair recognizes Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Joint Resolution 12.
Representative Holby moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Joint Resolution number 12. Is there any objection? Is there any discussion? Seeing or hearing none, the Dash 2 amendments to House Joint Resolution number 12 are adopted. Committee members, just a reminder that the motion the chair is going to be looking for here momentarily, because this is a resolution, is slightly different than a bill. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we send House Joint Resolution 12 as amended to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Representative Barnhart moves to adopt House Joint Resolution 12 as amended. Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Dell?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lynn?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Votes aye. Having received the majority, House Joint Resolution 12 is sent to the floor as amended and adopted. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I carry that here?
Yes. Thank you, Vice Chair Lim. We would be honored to have you carry that resolution to the floor, please.
Thank you very much. Can I make a small comment?
Please do.
Okay, I just want to thank you, each member of this committee, for the unanimously adopt and support of this House Joint Resolution 12. And this means a lot to the Korean community, not only here in Oregon, but nationwide. We have more than 2 million Korean Americans living in the United States, making a great contribution to this great country. And then I'm sure the Korean Americans living in Oregon, they will be very proud what we had just have done and for this great cause. This is not just a Korean American Day. It's not just for the Koreans. It is for all Americans, for all the Oregonians, and also the coming generations also. So just want to thank you. And also just want to thank you for the ERB and plus many other members who supported what happened today. Thank you very much.
And Vice Chair Lim, we want to thank you very much for bringing this resolution that recognizes one of our country's most important trading partners. Thank you very much. With that, Chair's already noted that we're going to carry over House Bill 2447. And with that, seeing no further business today, unless anyone has anything here, spur of the moment. With that, our committee stands adjourned until Friday. Thank you very much.